to forget, Monsieur le Comte, that the very day following the one in which you kindly prevented my disappointment respecting the horses, you saved the life of my dear friend, Madame de Villefort, which I had placed in danger by lending her the very animals your generosity restored to me. This time, at least, I cannot accept of your flattering acknowledgments. In the latter affair, you owe me nothing. Ali, my Nubian slave, was the fortunate individual who enjoyed the privilege of rendering to your friend the trifling assistance you allude to.
Was it Ali, asked the Comte de Morcerf, who rescued my son from the hands of bandits?
No, Monsieur le Comte, replied Monte Cristo, pressing with friendly warmth the hand held out to him by the general. In this instance, I may fairly and freely accept your thanks. But you have already tendered them, and fully discharged your debt, if indeed there existed one, and I feel almost mortified to find you still revert to the trifling aid I was able to render your son. May I beg of you, Madame la Baronne, to honour me with an introduction to your charming daughter?
Oh, you are no stranger, at least not by name, replied Madame Danglars, and the last two or three days we have really talked of nothing else but yourself.
Eugénie, continued the Baroness, turning towards her daughter, Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo. The Count bowed, while Mademoiselle Danglars returned a slight inclination of the head.
"You have a charming young person with you tonight, Monsieur le Comte," said Eugénie. "Your daughter, I presume."
"No, indeed," said Monte Cristo, astonished at the coolness and freedom of the question. "The female you allude to is a poor unfortunate Greek left under my care."
"And what is her name?"
"Aide," replied Monte Cristo.
"A Greek," murmured the Comte de Morcerf.
"Yes, indeed, Count," said Madame Danglars. "And tell me, did you ever see at the court of Ali Tebelin, whom you so gloriously and valiantly served, a more exquisite beauty or richer costume than is displayed in the fair Greek before us?"
"Did I hear rightly, Monsieur le Comte," said Monte Cristo, "that you served at Janina?"
"I was inspector general of the Pasha's troops," replied Morcerf, "and I seek not to conceal that I owe my fortune, such as it is, to the liberality of the illustrious Albanese chief."
"But look, pray look," exclaimed Madame Danglars.
"Where?" stammered out Morcerf.
"There, there," said Monte Cristo, as, wrapping his arms around the Count, he leaned with him over the front of the box, just as Aide, whose eyes were occupied in examining the theatre in search of the Count, perceived his pale marble features close to the countenance of Morcerf, whom he was holding in his arms. This sight produced on the astonished girl an effect similar to that of the fabulous head of Medusa. She bent forwards as though to assure herself of the reality of what she beheld, then, uttering a faint cry, threw herself back in her seat. The sound that burst from the agitated Greek quickly reached the ear of the watchful Ali, who instantly opened the box door to ascertain the cause.
"Bless me!" exclaimed Eugénie. "What has happened to your ward, Monsieur le Comte? She seems taken suddenly ill."
"Very probably," answered the Count. "But do not be alarmed on her account. Aide's nervous system is delicately organized, and she is peculiarly susceptible of the odors even of flowers. Nay, there are some which cause her to faint if brought into her presence. However," continued Monte Cristo, drawing a small phial from his pocket, "I have an infallible remedy for such attacks." So saying, he bowed to the Baroness and her daughter, exchanged a parting shake of the hand with Debray and the Count, and quitted the box. Upon his return to Aide, he found her extremely pale and much agitated. Directly she saw him, she seized his hand, while the icy coldness of her own made Monte Cristo start.
"With whom was my lord conversing a few minutes since?" asked she, in a trembling voice.
"With the Comte de Morcerf," answered Monte Cristo. "He tells me he served your illustrious father, and that he owes his fortune to him."
"Base, cowardly traitor that he is!" exclaimed Aide, her eyes flashing with rage. "He it was who sold my beloved parent to the Turks, and the fortune he boasts of was the price of his treachery. Knowest thou not that, my dear lord?"
Something of this I heard in Epirus, said Monte Cristo, but the particulars are still unknown to me. You shall relate them to me, my child. They are, no doubt, both curious and interesting.
Yes, yes, but let us go hence, I beseech you. I feel as though it would kill me to remain longer near that dreadful man.
So saying, Aide arose, and wrapping herself in her burnous of white cashmere, embroidered with pearls and coral, she hastily quitted the box, at the moment when the curtain was rising upon the fourth act.
"Do you observe," said the Countess G. to Albert, who had returned to her side, "that man does nothing like other people. He listens most devoutly to the third act of Robert le Diable, and when the fourth begins, makes a precipitate retreat."
55. A Talk About Stocks. Some days after this meeting, Albert de Morcerf visited the Count of Monte Cristo at his house in the Champs-Élysées, which had already assumed that palace-like appearance which the Count's princely fortune enabled him to give even to his most temporary residences. He came to renew the thanks of Madame Danglars, which had been already conveyed to the Count through the medium of a letter signed Baron Danglars, née Herminie de Servieux. Albert was accompanied by Lucien Debray, who, joining in his friend's conversation, added some passing compliments, the source of which the Count's talent for finesse easily enabled him to guess. He was convinced that Lucien's visit to him was to be attributed to a double feeling of curiosity, the larger half of which sentiment emanated from the Rue de la Chaussée d'Antin. In short, Madame Danglars, not being able personally to examine in detail the domestic economy and household arrangements of a man who gave away horses worth 30,000 francs, and who went to the opera with a Greek slave wearing diamonds to the amount of a million of money, had deputed those eyes by which she was accustomed to see to give her a faithful account of the mode of life of this incomprehensible individual. But the Count did not appear to suspect there could be the slightest connection between Lucien's visit and the Baroness's curiosity.
"You are in constant communication, then, with the Baron Danglars?" inquired the Count of Albert de Morcerf.
"Yes, Count. You know what I told you."
"All remains the same, then, in that quarter?"
"It is more than ever a settled thing," said Lucien.
And considering this remark was all that he was at that time called upon to make, he adjusted the glass to his eye, and biting the top of his gold-headed cane, began to make the tour of the apartment, examining the arms and the pictures.
"Ah," said Monte Cristo, "I did not expect the affair would have been so promptly concluded."
"Oh, things take their course without our assistance. Whilst we are forgetting them, they are falling into their appointed order, and when again our attention is directed to them, we are surprised at the progress they have made towards the proposed end. My father and Monsieur Danglars served together in Spain, my father in the army and Monsieur Danglars in the commissariat department. It was there that my father, ruined by the revolution, and Monsieur Danglars, who never had possessed any patrimony, both laid the foundation of their different fortunes."
"Yes," said Monte Cristo, "I think Monsieur Danglars mentioned that in a visit which I paid him." "And," continued he, casting a side glance at Lucien, who was turning over the leaves of an album, "is Mademoiselle Eugénie pretty? For I think I remember that to be her name."
"Very pretty, or rather, very beautiful," replied Albert, "but of that style of beauty which I do not appreciate. I am an ungrateful fellow."
"You speak as if you were already her husband."
"Ah," returned Albert, in his turn looking round to see what Lucien was doing.
"Really," said Monte Cristo, lowering his voice, "you do not appear to me to be very enthusiastic on the subject of this marriage."
"Mademoiselle Danglars is too rich for me," replied Morcerf, "and that frightens me."
"Bah!" exclaimed Monte Cristo, "that's a fine reason to give. Are you not rich yourself?"
"My father's income is about 50,000 francs per annum, and he will give me, perhaps, 10,000 or 12,000 when I marry."
"That, perhaps, might not be considered a large sum, in Paris especially," said the Count. "But everything does not depend on wealth, and it is a fine thing to have a good name and to occupy a high station in society."
Your name is celebrated, your position magnificent. And then the Comte de Morcerf is a soldier, and it is pleasing to see the integrity of a Bayard united to the poverty of a du Guesclin. Disinterestedness is the brightest ray in which a noble sword can shine. As for me, I consider the union with Mademoiselle Danglars a most suitable one. She will enrich you, and you will ennoble her. Albert shook his head and looked thoughtful. There is still something else, said he. I confess, observed Monte Cristo, that I have some difficulty in comprehending your objection to a young lady who is both rich and beautiful. Oh, said Morcerf, this repugnance, if repugnance it may be called, is not all on my side. Whence can it arise, then? For you told me your father desired the marriage. My mother's is the dissenting voice. She has a clear and penetrating judgment, and does not smile on the proposed union. I cannot account for it, but she seems to entertain some prejudice against the Danglars. Ah, said the Count, in a somewhat forced tone. That may be easily explained. Madame la Comtesse de Morcerf, who is aristocracy and refinement itself, does not relish the idea of being allied by your marriage with one of ignoble birth. That is natural enough. I do not know if that is her reason, said Albert, but one thing I do know, that if this marriage be consummated, it will render her quite miserable. There was to have been a meeting 6 weeks ago in order to talk over and settle the affair, but I had such a sudden attack of indisposition. Real, interrupted the Count, smiling. Oh, real enough, from anxiety, doubtless, that they postponed the rendezvous for 2 months longer. There is no hurry, you know. I am not yet 21, and Eugenie is only 17 years of age. But the 2 months expire next week. It must be done. My dear Count, you cannot imagine how my mind is harassed, how happy you are in being exempted from all this. Well, and why should not you be free, too? What prevents you from being so? Oh, it will be too great a disappointment to my father if I do not marry Mademoiselle Danglars. Marry her, then, said the Count, with a significant shrug of the shoulders. Yes, replied Morcerf, but that will plunge my mother into positive grief. Then do not marry her, said the Count. Well, I shall see. I will try and think over what is the best thing to be done. You will give me your advice, will you not? And if possible, extricate me from my unpleasant position. I think, rather than give pain to my excellent mother, I would run the risk of offending the Count. Monte Cristo turned away. He seemed moved by this last remark. Ha! Said he to Debray, who had thrown himself into an easy chair at the farthest extremity of the salon, and who held a pencil in his right hand and an account book in his left. What are you doing there? Are you making a sketch after Poussin?
No, no. I am doing something of a very opposite nature to painting. I am engaged with arithmetic.
Arithmetic?
Yes. I am calculating. By the way, Morcerf, that indirectly concerns you. I am calculating what the House of Danglars must have gained by the last rise in Haiti stock. From 206, they have risen to 409 in 3 days, and the prudent banker had purchased at 206. Therefore, he must have made 300,000 livres.
That is not his best stroke of policy, said Morcerf. Did he not gain 1 million from the Spaniards this last year?
My dear fellow, said Lucien, here is the Count of Monte Cristo, who will say to you, as the Italians do, denaro e santia, meta della meta. When they tell me such things, I only shrug my shoulders and say nothing.
But you were speaking of Haiti, said Monte Cristo.
Ah, Haiti, that is quite another thing. Haiti is the écarté of French stock-jobbing. They may, like La Bouillotte, delight in whist, be enraptured with Le Boston, and yet grow tired of all. But they always come back to écarté. That is the game par excellence. Monsieur Danglars sold yesterday at 4:05 and pockets 300,000 francs. Had he but waited till today, the stocks would have fallen to 2:05, and instead of gaining 300,000 francs, he would have lost 20 or 25,000.
And what has caused the sudden fall from 4:09 to 2:06? Asked Monte Cristo. I am profoundly ignorant of all these stock-jobbing intrigues.
Because, said Albert, laughing, one piece of news follows another, and there is often great dissimilarity between them.
Ah, said the Count, I see that Monsieur Danglars is accustomed to play at gaining or losing 300,000 francs in a day. He must be enormously rich.
It is not he who plays, exclaimed Lucien. It is Madame Danglars. She is indeed daring.
But you, who are a reasonable being, Lucien, and who know how little dependence is to be placed on the news since you are at the fountainhead, surely you ought to prevent it, said Morcerf with a smile.
How can I, if her husband fails in controlling her? Asked Lucien. You know the character of the Baroness. No one has any influence with her, and she does precisely what she pleases.
Ah, if I were in your place, said Albert.
Well?
I would reform her. It would be rendering a service to her future son-in-law.
How would you set about it?
Ah, that would be easy enough. I would give her a lesson.
A lesson?
Yes. Your position as secretary to the minister renders your authority on the subject of political news. You never open your mouth, but the stockbrokers immediately stenograph your words. Cause her to lose 200,000 or 300,000 francs in a short space of time, and that would teach her prudence.
I do not understand, stammered Lucien.
It is very clear, notwithstanding, replied the young man, with a naivete totally free from all affectation. Tell her some fine morning an unheard-of piece of intelligence, some telegraphic despatch of which you alone are in possession. For instance, that Henri IV was seen yesterday at the house of Gabrielle. That will cause the funds to rise. She will lay her plans accordingly, and she will certainly lose when Beauchamp announces the following day in his Gazette the report which has been circulated by some individuals stating the king to have been seen yesterday at Gabrielle's house is totally without foundation. We can positively assert that His Majesty did not quit the Pont Neuf.
Lucien half smiled. Monte Cristo, although apparently indifferent, had not lost one word of this conversation, and his penetrating eye had even read a hidden secret in the embarrassed manner of the secretary. This embarrassment had completely escaped Albert, but it caused Lucien to shorten his visit. He was evidently ill at ease. The Count, in taking leave of him, said something in a low voice, to which he answered,
"Willingly, Monsieur le Comte. I accept your proposal."
The Count returned to young de Morcerf.
"Do you not think on reflection," said he to him, "that you have done wrong in thus speaking of your mother-in-law in the presence of Monsieur de Bray?"
"Monsieur le Comte," said Morcerf, "I beg of you not to apply that title so prematurely. Now, speaking without any exaggeration, is your mother really so very much averse to this marriage? So much so that the Baroness very rarely comes to the house, and my mother has not, I think, visited Madame Danglars twice in her whole life."
"Then," said the Count, "I am emboldened to speak openly to you. Monsieur Danglars is my banker. Monsieur de Villefort has overwhelmed me with politeness in return for a service which a casual piece of good fortune enabled me to render him. I predict from all this an avalanche of dinners and routs. Now, in order not to appear to expect such a proceeding, and also to be beforehand with them, if you like it, I have thought of inviting Monsieur and Madame Danglars and Monsieur and Madame de Villefort to my country house at Auteuil. If I were to invite you and the Comte and Comtesse de Morcerf to this dinner, it would give it the air of a matrimonial rendezvous, or at least Madame de Morcerf would look upon the affair in that light, especially if Monsieur le Baron Danglars did me the honour to bring his daughter.
In that case, your mother would hold me in aversion, and I do not at all wish that. On the contrary, I desire to occupy a prominent place in her esteem. Indeed, Count, said Morcerf, I thank you sincerely for having used so much candor towards me, and I gratefully accept the exclusion which you propose to me. You say you desire my mother's good opinion. I assure you, it is already yours to a very unusual extent.
Do you think so? Said Monte Cristo with interest.
Oh, I am sure of it. We talked of you an hour after you left us the other day. But to return to what we were saying, if my mother could know of this attention on your part, and I will venture to tell her, I am sure that she will be most grateful to you. It is true that my father will be equally angry. The Count laughed. Well, said he to Morcerf, but I think your father will not be the only angry one. Monsieur and Madame Danglars will think me a very ill-mannered person. They know that I am intimate with you, that you are, in fact, one of the oldest of my Parisian acquaintances, and they will not find you at my house. They will certainly ask me why I did not invite you. Be sure to provide yourself with some previous engagement which shall have a semblance of probability, and communicate the fact to me by a line in writing. You know that with bankers nothing but a written document will be valid. I will do better than that, said Albert. My mother is wishing to go to the seaside. What day is fixed for your dinner?
Saturday.
This is Tuesday. Well, tomorrow evening we leave, and the day after we shall be at Tréport. Really, Monsieur le Comte, you are a charming person to set people at their ease. Indeed, you give me more credit than I deserve. I only wish to do what will be agreeable to you, that is all. When shall you send your invitations? This very day. Well, I will immediately call on Monsieur Danglars and tell him that my mother and myself leave Paris tomorrow. I have not seen you. Consequently, I know nothing of your dinner. How foolish you are! Have you forgotten that Monsieur Debray has just seen you at my house?
Ah, true.
On the contrary, I have seen you and invited you without any ceremony, when you instantly answered that it would be impossible for you to be amongst the number of my guests, as you were going to Tréport. Well, then, that is settled. But you will come and call on my mother before tomorrow.
Before tomorrow?
That will be a difficult matter to arrange. Besides, I shall just be in the way of all the preparations for departure. You were only a charming man before, but if you accede to my proposal, you will be adorable. What must I do to attain such a height? You are today free as air. Come and dine with me. We shall be a small party, only yourself, my mother, and I. You have scarcely seen my mother. You shall have an opportunity of observing her more closely. She is a remarkable woman, and I only regret that there does not exist another who resembles her about 20 years younger. In that case, I assure you, there would very soon be a Comtesse and Vicomtesse de Morcerf. As to my father, you will not see him. He is officially engaged and dines with Monsieur le Grand Referendaire. We will talk over our travels, and you, who have seen the whole world, will relate your adventures. You shall tell us the history of the beautiful Greek who was with you the other night at the opera, and whom you call your slave and yet treat like a princess. We will talk Italian and Spanish. Come, accept my invitation, and my mother will thank you.
A thousand thanks, said the Count. Your invitation is most gracious, and I regret exceedingly that it is not in my power to accept it. I am not so much at liberty as you supposed. On the contrary, I have a most important engagement.
Ah, take care. You were teaching me just now how, in case of an invitation to dinner, one might creditably make an excuse. I require the proof of a pre-engagement. I am not a banker like Monsieur Danglars, but I am quite as incredulous as he is.
I am going to give you a proof, replied the Count, and he rang the bell.
Humph, said Morcerf, this is the second time you have refused to dine with my mother. It is evident you wish to avoid her.
Monte Cristo started.
Oh, you do not mean that, said he. Besides, here comes the confirmation of my assertion. But he entered and remained standing at the door.
I had no previous knowledge of your visit, had I?
Indeed, you are such an extraordinary person that I would not answer for it,
At all events, I could not guess that you would invite me to dinner. Probably not. Well, listen. Baptistin, what did I tell you this morning when I called you into my laboratory? To close the door against visitors as soon as the clock struck 5, replied the valet. What then? Monsieur le Comte, said Albert, no. I wish to do away with that mysterious reputation that you have given me, my dear Viscount. It is tiresome to be always acting Manfred. I wish my life to be free and open. Go on, Baptistin.
Then to admit no one except Monsieur le Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti and his son.
You hear? Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti, a man who ranks amongst the most ancient nobility of Italy, whose name Dante has celebrated in the 10th canto of L'Inferno. You remember it, do you not? Then there is his son, a charming young man about your own age, Viscount, bearing the same title as yourself, and who is making his entree into the Parisian world, aided by his father's millions. The Major will bring his son with him this evening, the Contino, as we say in Italy. He confides him to my care. If he proves himself worthy of it, I will do what I can to advance his interests. You will assist me in the work, will you not?
Most undoubtedly.
This Major Cavalcanti is an old friend of yours, then?
By no means. He is a perfect nobleman, very polite, modest, and agreeable, such as may be found constantly in Italy, descendants of very ancient families. I have met him several times at Florence, Bologna, and Lucca, and he has now communicated to me the fact of his arrival in this place. The acquaintances one makes in travelling have a sort of claim on one. They everywhere expect to receive the same attention which you once paid them by chance, as though the civilities of a passing hour were likely to awaken any lasting interest in favour of the man in whose society you may happen to be thrown in the course of your journey. This good Major Cavalcanti is come to take a second view of Paris, which he only saw in passing through in the time of the Empire, when he was on his way to Moscow. I shall give him a good dinner. He will confide his son to my care. I will promise to watch over him. I shall let him follow in whatever path his folly may lead him, and then I shall have done my part.
Certainly. I see you are a precious mentor, said Albert. Goodbye. We shall return on Sunday. By the way, I have received news of France.
Have you? Is he still amusing himself in Italy?
I believe so. However, he regrets your absence extremely. He says you were the sun of Rome, and that without you all appears dark and cloudy. I do not know if he does not even go so far as to say that it rains. His opinion of me is altered for the better, then. No, he still persists in looking upon you as the most incomprehensible and mysterious of beings.
He is a charming young man, said Monte Cristo, and I felt a lively interest in him the very first evening of my introduction, when I met him in search of a supper, and prevailed upon him to accept a portion of mine. He is, I think, the son of General d'Epernay?
He is. The same who was so shamefully assassinated in 1815 by the Bonapartists.
Yes. Really, I like him extremely. Is there not also a matrimonial engagement contemplated for him?
Yes, he is to marry Mademoiselle de Villefort.
Indeed.
And you know I am to marry Mademoiselle Danglars, said Albert, laughing.
You smile?
Yes.
Why do you do so?
I smile because there appears to me to be about as much inclination for the consummation of the engagement in question as there is for my own. But really, my dear Count, we are talking as much of women as they do of us. It is unpardonable.
Albert rose. Are you going?
Really, that is a good idea of yours. 2 hours have I been boring you to death with my company, and then you, with the greatest politeness, ask me if I am going. Indeed, Count, you are the most polished man in the world. And your servants, too, how very well behaved they are. There is quite a style about them. Monsieur Baptistin especially. I could never get such a man as that. My servants seem to imitate those you sometimes see in a play, who, because they have only a word or two to say, acquit themselves in the most awkward manner possible. Therefore, if you part with Monsieur Baptistin, give me the refusal of him.
Agreed, Viscount.
That is not all. give my compliments to your illustrious visitor Cavalcante of the Cavalcanti, and if by any chance he should be wishing to establish his son, find him a wife very rich, very noble on her mother's side at least, and a baroness in right of her father, I will help you in the search. Oh, you will do as much as that, will you?
Yes.
Well, really, nothing is certain in this world. Oh, Count, what a service you might render me. I should like you 100 times better if, by your intervention, I could manage to remain a bachelor, even were it only for 10 years. Nothing is impossible, gravely replied Monte Cristo, and taking leave of Albert, he returned into the house and struck the gong 3 times. Bertuccio appeared. Monsieur Bertuccio, you understand that I intend entertaining company on Saturday at Ortoy. Bertuccio slightly started. I shall require your services to see that all be properly arranged. It is a beautiful house, or, at all events, may be made so.
There must be a good deal done before it can deserve that title, Monsieur le Comte, for the tapestried hangings are very old.
Let them all be taken away and changed, then, with the exception of the sleeping chamber, which is hung with red damask. You will leave that exactly as it is. Bertuccio bowed. You will not touch the garden, either. As to the yard, you may do what you please with it. I shall prefer that being altered beyond all recognition. I will do everything in my power to carry out your wishes, Monsieur le Comte. I should be glad, however, to receive your Excellency's commands concerning the dinner. Really, my dear Monsieur Bertuccio, said the Count, since you have been in Paris, you have become quite nervous, and apparently out of your element. You no longer seem to understand me. But surely your Excellency will be so good as to inform me whom you are expecting to receive.
I do not yet know myself. Neither is it necessary that you should do so. Lucullus dines with Lucullus. That is quite sufficient.
Bertuccio bowed and left the room. 56. Major Cavalcanti. Both the Count and Battistan had told the truth when they announced to Morcerf the proposed visit of the Major, which had served Monte Cristo as a pretext for declining the invitation which he had received from Albert. 7 o'clock had just struck, and Monsieur Bertuccio, according to the command which had been given him, had 2 hours before left for Auteuil, when a fiacre stopped at the door of the hotel, and after depositing its occupant at the gate, immediately hurried away, as if ashamed of its employment. The individual who alighted from the vehicle was about 52 years of age, dressed in one of those green surtouts ornamented with black frogs, which have so long maintained their popularity all over Europe. He wore trousers of blue cloth, boots tolerably clean, but not of the brightest polish, and a little too thick in the soles, buckskin gloves, a hat somewhat resembling in shape those usually worn by the gendarmes, and a black cravat striped with white, which, if the proprietor had not worn it of his own free will, might have passed for a halter, so much did it resemble one. Such was the picturesque costume of the person who rang at the gate and demanded if it was not number 30 in the Avenue des Champs-Élysées that Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo inhabited, and who, being answered by the porter in the affirmative, entered, closed the gate after him, and began to ascend the steps of the house. The small and angular head of the individual in question, his white hair and thick grey moustache, caused him to be easily recognised by Battistin, who had received an exact description of the expected visitor, and who was awaiting him in the hall. Therefore, scarcely had the stranger time to pronounce his name before the Count was apprised of his arrival. He was ushered into a simple and elegant drawing-room, and the Count rose to meet him with a smiling air.
"Ah, my dear sir, you are most welcome. I was expecting you."
"Indeed," said the Italian. "Was your Excellency, then, aware of my visit?"
"Yes. I had been told that I should see you today at 7 o'clock."
"Then you have received full information concerning my arrival, decidedly. But you are sure you are not mistaken? I am quite sure of it. It really was I whom your Excellency expected at 7 o'clock this evening? I will prove it to you beyond a doubt." "Oh, no, never mind that," said the Italian. "It is not worth the trouble."
"Yes,
yes," said Monte Cristo.
His visitor appeared slightly uneasy.
"Let me see," said the Count. "Are you not Monsieur le Marquis Bartolomeo Cavalcanti?"
"Bartolomeo Cavalcanti," joyfully replied the Italian. "Yes, I am. Really, he, ex-major in the Austrian service." "Was I a major?" timidly asked the old soldier.
"Yes," said Monte Cristo, "you were a major. That is the title the French give to the post which you filled in Italy."
"Oh, very good," said the major. "I do not demand more, you understand.
Your visit here today is not of your own suggestion, is it?" said Monte Cristo.
No, certainly not.
You were sent by some other person?"
"Yes."
"By the excellent Abbe Busoni?"
"Exactly so," said the delighted major.
"And you have a letter?"
"Yes, there it is. Give it me then."
And Monte Cristo took the letter, which he opened and read.
"Yes, yes, I see. Major Cavalcanti, a worthy patrician of Lucca, a descendant of the Cavalcanti of Florence," continued Monte Cristo, reading aloud, "possessing an income of 500,000.
"Oh, 500,000, is it?" said the major.
"Yes, in so many words. And it must be so, for the abbe knows correctly the amount of all the largest fortunes in Europe."
"Be it 500,000, then. But on my word of honour, I had no idea that it was so much."
"Because you are robbed by your steward. You must make some reformation in that quarter."
"You have opened my eyes," said the Italian gravely. "I will show the gentleman the door."
Monte Cristo resumed the perusal of the letter. "And who only needs one thing more to make him happy?"
"Yes, indeed. But one," said the major with a sigh,
"which is to recover a lost and adored son."
"A lost and adored son.
Stolen away in his infancy, either by an enemy of his noble family or by the gypsies."
"At the age of 5 years, sir," said the major with a deep sigh, and raising his eyes to heaven.
"Unhappy father," said Monte Cristo. The Count continued, "I have given him renewed life and hope in the assurance that you have the power of restoring the son whom he has vainly sought for 15 years. The major looked at the Count with an indescribable expression of anxiety.
"I have the power of so doing," said Monte Cristo. The major recovered his self-possession.
"Ah, ah," said he, "the letter was true, then, to the end?"
"Did you doubt it, Monsieur Bartolomeo?"
"No, indeed, certainly not. A good man, a man holding a religious office, as does the Abbe Busoni, could not condescend to deceive or play off a joke. But your excellency has not read all."
"Ah, true," said Monte Cristo. "There is a postscript."
"Yes," repeated the major. "Yes, there is a postscript.
In order to save Major Cavalcanti the trouble of drawing on his banker, I send him a draft for 2,000 francs to defray his travelling expenses, and credit on you for the further sum of 48,000, which you still owe me." The major awaited the conclusion of the postscript, apparently with great anxiety.
"Very good," said the Count.
"He said, 'Very good,'" muttered the major. "Then, sir," replied he.
"Then what?" asked Monte Cristo.
"Then the postscript."
"Well, what of the postscript?"
"Then the postscript is as favourably received by you as the rest of the letter?"
"Certainly." "You attached great importance, then, to this postscript, my dear Monsieur Cavalcanti. Is it possible that a man of your standing should be embarrassed anywhere?" said Monte Cristo.
"Why, really, I know no one," said the major.
"But then you yourself are known to others."
"Yes, I am known. So that..."
"Proceed, my dear Monsieur Cavalcanti.
So that you will remit to me these 48,000 francs?"
"Certainly, at your first request." The major's eyes dilated with pleasing astonishment.
"But sit down,"
said Monte Cristo. "Really, I do not know what I have been thinking of. I have positively kept you standing for the last quarter of an hour. Don't mention it." The Major drew an armchair towards him and proceeded to seat himself. "Now," said the Count, "what will you take? A glass of port, sherry, or vin d'Alicant?"
"A vin d'Alicant, if you please. It is my favorite wine. I have some which is excellent. You will take a biscuit with it, will you not?" "Yes, I will take a biscuit, as you are so obliging."
Monte Cristo rang. Baptistin appeared. The Count advanced to meet him. "Well," said he in a low voice. "The young man is here," said the valet de chambre, in the same tone. "Into what room did you take him?"
"Into the blue drawing-room, according to your excellency's orders."
"That's right. Now bring the vin d'Alicant and some biscuits." Baptistin left the room.
"Really," said the Major, "I am quite ashamed of the trouble I am giving you."
"Pray don't mention such a thing," said the Count. Baptistin re-entered with glasses, wine, and biscuits. The Count filled one glass, but in the other he only poured a few drops of the ruby-coloured liquid. The bottle was covered with spider's webs, and all the other signs which indicate the age of wine more truly than do wrinkles on the face of a man. The Major made a wise choice. He took the full glass and a biscuit. The Count told Baptistin to leave the plate within reach of his guest, who began by sipping the Alicant with an expression of great satisfaction, and then delicately steeped his biscuit in the wine.
"So, sir, you inhabited Lucca, did you? You were rich, noble, held in great esteem, had all that could render a man happy?"
All, said the Major, hastily swallowing his biscuit. "Positively all. And yet there was one thing wanting in order to complete your happiness?"
"Only one thing," said the Italian.
"And that one thing, your lost child."
"Ah," said the Major, taking a second biscuit, "that consummation of my happiness was indeed wanting."
The worthy Major raised his eyes to heaven and sighed. "Let me hear, then," said the Count, "who this deeply regretted son was. For I always understood you were a bachelor."
"That was the general opinion, sir," said the Major. "And I..."
"Yes," replied the Count, "and you confirmed the report. A youthful indiscretion, I suppose, which you were anxious to conceal from the world at large?" The Major recovered himself and resumed his usual calm manner, at the same time casting his eyes down, either to give himself time to compose his countenance or to assist his imagination, all the while giving an underlook at the Count, the protracted smile on whose lips still announced the same polite curiosity.
"Yes," said the Major, "I did wish this fault to be hidden from every eye."
"Not on your account, surely," replied Monte Cristo, "for a man is above all these things."
"Oh, no, certainly not on my own account," said the Major, with a smile and a shake of the head.
"But for the sake of the mother," said the Count.
"Yes, for the mother's sake, his poor mother," cried the Major, taking a third biscuit.
"She belonged to one of the first families in Italy, I think, did she not?"
"She was of a noble family of Fiesole, Monsieur le Comte."
"And her name was..."
"Do you desire to know her name?"
"Oh," said Monte Cristo, "it would be quite superfluous for you to tell me, for I already know it. Oliva Corsinari, was it not?"
"Oliva Corsinari. A marchioness?"
"A marchioness. And you married her at last, notwithstanding the opposition of her family?"
"Yes, I did so. And you have doubtless brought all your papers with you," said Monte Cristo.
"What papers?"
"The certificate of your marriage with Oliva Corsinari, and the register of your child's birth."
"The register of my child's birth?"
"The register of the birth of Andrea Cavalcanti, of your son. Is not his name Andrea?"
"I believe so," said the Major. What? You are not sure that is his name? I dare not positively assert it, as he has been lost for so long a time. Well then, said Monte Cristo, you have all the documents with you? Monsieur le Comte, I regret to say that, not knowing it was necessary to come provided with these papers, I neglected to bring them with me.
That is unfortunate, returned Monte Cristo.
Were they then so necessary? They were indispensable. The Major passed his hand across his brow.
Ah, poor Baccio, indispensable, were they?
Certainly they were. Supposing there were to be doubts raised as to the validity of your marriage, or the legitimacy of your child.
True, said the Major, there might be doubts raised.
In that case your son would be very unpleasantly situated.
It would be fatal to his interests.
It might cause him to fail in some desirable matrimonial speculation.
Oh, peccato!
You must know that in France they are very particular on these points. It is not sufficient, as in Italy, to go to the priest and say, "We love each other and want you to marry us." Marriage is a civil affair in France, and in order to marry in an orthodox manner, you must have papers which undeniably establish your identity. That is the misfortune. You see, I have not these necessary papers.
Fortunately, I have them, though, said Monte Cristo.
Ah, indeed, said the Major, who, seeing the object of his journey frustrated by the absence of the papers, feared also that his forgetfulness might give rise to some difficulty concerning the 48,000 francs.
Ah, indeed, that is a fortunate circumstance. Yes, that really is lucky, for it never occurred to me to bring them.
I do not at all wonder at it. One cannot think of everything. But happily, the Abbé Busoni thought for you.
He is an admirable man, said the Major. And he sent them to you?
Here they are. The Major clasped his hands in token of admiration. You married Oliva Corsinari in the church of San Paolo del Monte Catini. Here is the priest's certificate.
Yes, indeed, there it is, truly, said the Italian, looking on with astonishment.
And here is Andrea Cavalcanti's baptismal register, given by the Cure of Saravezza.
All quite correct.
Take these documents, then. They do not concern me. You will give them to your son, who will, of course, take great care of them.
I should think so, indeed. If he were to lose them, it would be necessary to write to the curé for duplicates, and it would be some time before they could be obtained.
It would be a difficult matter to arrange, said Monte Cristo.
Almost an impossibility, replied the Major.
I am very glad to see that you understand the value of these papers.
I regard them as invaluable.
Now, said Monte Cristo, as to the mother of the young man.
As to the mother of the young man, repeated the Italian with anxiety.
As regards La Marquise Corsinari.
Really, said the Major, difficulties seem to thicken upon us. Will she be wanted in any way?
No, sir, replied Monte Cristo. Besides, has she not?
Yes, said the Major. She has
paid the last debt of nature?
Alas, yes, returned the Italian.
I knew that, said Monte Cristo. She has been dead these 10 years,
and I am still mourning her loss, exclaimed the Major, drawing from his pocket a checked handkerchief and alternately wiping first the right and then the left eye.
What would you have? Said Monte Cristo. We are all mortal.
Now you understand, my dear Monsieur Cavalcanti, that it is useless for you to tell people in France that you have been separated from your son for 15 years. Stories of gypsies who steal children are not at all in vogue in this part of the world and would not be believed.
You sent him for his education to a college in one of the provinces, and now you wish him to complete his education in the Parisian world. That is the reason which has induced you to leave Via Reggio, where you have lived since the death of your wife. That will be sufficient. Very well, then. If they should hear of the separation, yes, what could I say, that an unfaithful tutor brought over by the enemies of your family, by the Corsinari, precisely, had stolen away this child in order that your name might become extinct. That will do well, since he is an only son. Well, now that all is arranged, do not let these newly awakened remembrances be forgotten. You have, doubtless, already guessed that I was preparing a surprise for you. Someone has told you the secret, or perhaps you guessed that he was here.
That who was here?
Your child, your son, your Andrea. I did guess it, replied the Major with the greatest sang-froid possible. Then he is here. He is, said Monte Cristo. When the valet de chambre came in just now, he told me of his arrival.
Ah, very well, very well, said the Major, clutching the buttons of his coat at each exclamation which he made.
My dear sir, said Monte Cristo, I understand all your emotion. You must have time to recover yourself. I will, in the meantime, go and prepare the young man for this much-desired interview, for I presume that he is not less impatient for it than yourself.
I should quite imagine that to be the case, said Cavalcanti.
Well, in a quarter of an hour he shall be with you.
You will bring him, then. You carry your goodness so far as even to present him to me yourself?
No, I do not wish to come between a father and son. Your interview will be private. But do not be uneasy. Even if the powerful voice of nature should be silent, you cannot well mistake him. He will enter by this door. He is a fine young man of fair complexion, a little too fair, perhaps, pleasing manners. But you will see and judge for yourself.
By the way, said the Major, you know I have only the 2,000 francs which the Abbe Busoni sent me. This sum I have expended upon travelling expenses, and
you want money. That is a matter of course, my dear Monsieur Cavalcanti. Well, here are 8,000 francs on account. The Major's eyes sparkled brilliantly. It is 40,000 francs which I now owe you, said Monte Cristo.
Does your excellency wish for a receipt? Said the Major, at the same time slipping the money into the inner pocket of his coat.
For what? Said the Count.
I thought you might want it to show the Abbe Busoni.
Well, when you receive the remaining 40,000, you shall give me a receipt in full. Between honest men, such excessive precaution is, I think, quite unnecessary.
Yes, so it is between perfectly upright people.
One word more, said Monte Cristo.
Say on. You will permit me to make one remark?
Certainly. Pray do so. Then I should advise you to leave off wearing that style of dress.
Indeed, said the Major, regarding himself with an air of complete satisfaction.
Yes, it may be worn at Via Reggio, but that costume, however elegant in itself, has long been out of fashion in Paris.
That's unfortunate.
Oh, if you really are attached to your old mode of dress, you can easily resume it when you leave Paris.
But what shall I wear?
What you find in your trunks?
In my trunks? I have but one portmanteau.
I dare say you have nothing else with you. What is the use of boring oneself with so many things? Besides, an old soldier always likes to march with as little baggage as possible.
That is just the case, precisely so.
You are a man of foresight and prudence. Therefore you sent your luggage on before you. It has arrived at the Hôtel de Prance, Rue de Richelieu. It is there you are to take up your quarters.
In these trunks,
I presume you have given orders to your valet de chambre to put in all you are likely to need, your plain clothes and your uniform. On grand occasions you must wear your uniform. That will look very well. Do not forget your crosses. They still laugh at them in France and yet always wear them for all that.
Very well.
"Very well," said the Major, who was in ecstasy at the attention paid him by the Count. "Now," said Monte Cristo, "that you have fortified yourself against all painful excitement, prepare yourself, my dear Monsieur Cavalcanti, to meet your lost Andrea." Saying which, Monte Cristo bowed and disappeared behind the tapestry, leaving the Major fascinated beyond expression with the delightful reception which the Count had given him. 57. Andrea Cavalcanti. The Count of Monte Cristo entered the adjoining room which Battistin had designated as the Blue Drawing Room, and found there a young man of graceful demeanour and elegant appearance, who had arrived in a fiacre about half an hour previously. Battistin had not found any difficulty in recognizing the individual who presented himself at the door for admittance. He was certainly the tall young man with light hair, red beard, black eyes, and brilliant complexion, whom his master had so particularly described to him. When the Count entered the room, the young man was carelessly stretched on a sofa, tapping his boot with the gold-headed cane which he held in his hand. On perceiving the Count, he rose quickly. "The Count of Monte Cristo, I believe," said he. "Yes, sir. And I think I have the honour of addressing Count Andrea Cavalcanti." "Count Andrea Cavalcanti," repeated the young man, accompanying his words with a bow. "You are charged with the letter of introduction addressed to me, are you not?" said the Count. "I did not mention that because the signature seemed to me so strange." "The letter is signed Sinbad the Sailor, is it not?" "Exactly so. Now, as I have never known any Sinbad, with the exception of the one celebrated in the Thousand and One Nights, well, it is one of his descendants and a great friend of mine. He is a very rich Englishman, eccentric almost to insanity, and his real name is Lord Wilmore." "Ah, indeed. Then that explains everything," said Andrea. "That is extraordinary. He is, then, the same Englishman whom I met at..." "Yes, very well. Monsieur le Comte, I am at your service." "If what you say be true," replied the Count, smiling, "perhaps you will be kind enough to give me some account of yourself and your family." "Certainly I will do so," said the young man, with a quickness which gave proof of his ready invention. "I am, as you have said, the Count Andrea Cavalcanti, son of Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti, a descendant of the Cavalcanti whose names are inscribed in the Golden Book of Florence. Our family, although still rich, for my father's income amounts to 500,000, has experienced many misfortunes, and I myself was, at the age of 5 years, taken away by the treachery of my tutor, so that for 15 years I have not seen the author of my existence. Since I have arrived at years of discretion and become my own master, I have been constantly seeking him, but all in vain. At length I received this letter from your friend, which states that my father is in Paris, and authorizes me to address myself to you for information respecting him." "Really, all you have related to me is exceedingly interesting," said Monte Cristo, observing the young man with a gloomy satisfaction. "And you have done well to conform in everything to the wishes of my friend Sinbad, for your father is indeed here, and is seeking you." The Count, from the moment of his first entering the drawing-room, had not once lost sight of the expression of the young man's countenance. He had admired the assurance of his look and the firmness of his voice. But at these words, so natural in themselves, "Your father is indeed here and is seeking you," young Andrea started and exclaimed, "My father? Is my father here?" "Most undoubtedly," replied Monte Cristo. "Your father, the Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti." The expression of terror which for the moment had overspread the features of the young man had now disappeared. "Ah, yes, that is the name, certainly, Major Bartolomeo Cavalcanti. And you really mean to say, Monsieur le Comte, that my dear father is here?" "Yes, sir, and I can even add that I have only just left his company. The history which he related to me of his lost son touched me to the quick. Indeed, his griefs, hopes, and fears on that subject might furnish material for a most touching and pathetic poem. At length, he one day received a letter stating that the parties who had deprived him of his son now offered to restore him, or at least to give notice where he might be found, on condition of receiving a large sum of money by way of ransom. Your father did not hesitate an instant, and the sum was sent to the frontier of Piedmont with a passport signed for Italy. You were in the south of France, I think.
Yes, replied Andrea with an embarrassed air. I was in the south of France.
A carriage was to await you at Nice?
Precisely so, and it conveyed me from Nice to Genoa, from Genoa to Turin, from Turin to Chambéry, from Chambéry to Pont de Beauvoisin, and from Pont de Beauvoisin to Paris, capital. He always hoped to meet you on the road, for that was the route he himself followed.